headlines, Ayatollah Khamenei approves amnesty and a commutation of sentences for a large number of people detained during the recent riots in Iran. Syria slams U.S.'s hostile policy, saying Washington and its allies use the same lies against Damascus that they used before in invading Iraq. And a senior Ukrainian lawmaker says the country's defense minister will be replaced following corruption scandals ahead of expected Russian offensive. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi and these are our top stories this hour. Now, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has pardoned and commuted the sentences of a large number of people arrested during the recent riots in the country. Ayatollah Khamenei issued the decree in response to a request by the Iranian judiciary on the occasion of the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. In his request, Ghulam Hossein Mohseni Eshe said many of those who committed crimes during the foreign-backed riots are now repentant and ask for forgiveness. Cases against those charged with crimes or convicted of them will now be dropped. The judiciary chief, however, said the clemency will not apply to those who committed espionage, murder, bodily harm, and vandalism. Those facing lawsuits by private litigations are not eligible for amnesty either. Ayatollah Khamenei has also granted amnesty to a number of people convicted of other crimes. Human rights activist Firas Al-Najim from Canada says amnesties on such a mass scale and regular basis are a mark of humane and merciful system, which is rare in Western countries.
I never hear in Canada them having any amnesty or pardons on a mass amount of people in Christmas or any different type of time, even holy times, right? There is certain cases where they probably pardon certain things maybe, or they're more lenient on a certain sentence or so on, but that's just, you know, case by case. But this is on a high level, on a big level, and this is not the first time. I mean, the Islamic Republic of Iran has done that on several occasions, especially holy times or Nowruz or things like that, you know. And I think this really shows Iran and the just system that the of Iran does really have. All these things into consideration. I mean, the people that were writing, some of them maybe were upset because of the high inflations, the sanctions, and so on, and their emotions got played together. And they went out there and they made some mistakes, and they joined these rallies and committed some crimes. And now look, they're looking into that and saying that, you know, some of them have repented, some of them have said that they made mistakes. So now they're letting them go, or they're listening to their sentences. But at the same time, they are holding the ones accountable that were spying for foreign countries, the ones that were stabbing police officers, the ones that were killing.
Iran and Cuba are two major victims of U.S. unilateral sanctions as well as interference. So when the two top diplomats of the countries met in Havana, they poured much scorn on U.S. imperialistic and interventionist policies. We discuss this in our news review program.
Iran's foreign minister says U.S. bullying and sanctions policy are doomed to failure. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remark in a meeting with his Cuban counterpart in Havana. The top Iranian diplomat reaffirmed Tehran's condemnation of foreign meddling in Cuba's affairs and the U.S. role in the 2021 riots in Caribbean country. Also referring to the recent unrest in Iran, Amir Abdullahian said the U.S. and some other Western states target sovereign countries by simultaneously imposing sanctions on them and provoking riots there. The Cuban foreign minister, for his part, also denounced unilateral sanctions and foreign interference. Bruno Rodriguez said enhancing ties with Iran is a priority for his country. Amir Abdullahian also earlier met with the Cuban president. He's on a foreign tour, which has already taken him to Mauritania, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. Now let's bring in Daniel Schott, Latin American expert from Munich, who joins us. We also have Joe Emers Berger, writer and political commentator, joining us from Windsor. I'd like to welcome to you both. And Daniel Shaw, if I may start with you. When you take a look at the common viewpoints that, for example, Iran and Cuba have in this case, since it's the most recent visit by the Iranian foreign minister, you can see that the approach is going to be pretty much the same when it comes to the Western world, particularly the U.S., actually. Are we seeing a trend here? Because this kind of mirrors the same thing that has happened to Venezuela. And, of course, Iran has also, the foreign minister, visited Venezuela. So we're looking at the same approaches here, aren't we?
That's exactly correct. The U.S.'s preferred weapon of war nowadays are sanctions, are an economic war to try to bring the populace of Iran, of China, of Russia, of Nicaragua, of Cuba, of Venezuela, of these different countries that they cannot economically and militarily and diplomatically control. They want to bring them to their knees. So what we are witnessing is an organic axis of the blockaded. We're seeing Tehran reach out to Caracas, and we're seeing Caracas reach out to Moscow, and Moscow reach out to Beijing to thwart these sanctions. We're seeing the sanctions still have an incredible human impact. Some 8 million Venezuelans have been forced from their homeland. Some 40,000 Venezuelans were killed from the sanctions in 2017. But the different blockaded countries are searching for ways to circumvent these sanctions and work with one another in humane ways so that they can transcend these foreign impositions from the U.S.
Well, Joe Emersberger, if we're taking a look at the fact that countries that are aligned together in this respect, like Iran and Cuba and Venezuela, and perhaps we can put Nicaragua in there, or any other countries that are sanctioned by the U.S., this long arm of U.S. sanctions is one of the things that are binding these countries together. Are we looking, and this is not something new in terms of trying to stop that, are we looking at the shift to already be in motion, and therefore when you see these countries enhancing their trade relations in particular, that they are going to be successful, and it's the U.S. that's going to be somewhat watching from the sidelines?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be overconfident either, but it's certainly true that this is bringing countries together as for survival to offset the monstrously murderous impact of U.S. sanctions. And I would add, it's also bringing together countries that aren't officially sanctioned, like Brazil. I mean, even very moderate figures could make an argument that, kind of a very timid argument, to say, well, if you're very inefficient, if Brazil wants to trade with Argentina, that they have to go through bank accounts in the United States. I mean, that's kind of silly, right? Why can't they just set up a payment system that bypasses the U.S. entirely? I mean, you can make an argument just in terms of economic efficiency, if that makes sense. But what's not said is obviously, why do you want to empower Washington to one day sanction you as well? They'll just add anybody to their list of countries that they're trying to destroy based on any pretext, no matter how ridiculous. So even the countries that aren't officially sanctioned are showing that they want to bypass the United States, even if they aren't putting it that bluntly.
Okay, thank you so much. Daniel Shaw, an American expert from Munich. And also Joe Emersberger, thank you, writer and political commentator, spoke to us on the phone from Windsor, Ontario. And that is it for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
The ninth meeting of the Joint Economic Cooperation Committee of Iran and Zimbabwe wrapped up its work in Tehran. The meeting has provided a platform for developing economic cooperation and improving the level of trade exchanges between the two countries. Saman Kutri reports.
The closing session of the ninth meeting of the Joint Economic Cooperation Committee of Iran and Zimbabwe was held in Tehran. During the meeting, the two sides stressed the importance of bilateral cooperation in the fields of agriculture, health, and facilitating exports of Iranian drugs into the Zimbabwean market. Iran and Zimbabwe officials agreed to use Iran's experiences in various fields, including the development of small and medium-sized enterprises, energy, and science.
Agriculture, exports of machinery, sale of petrochemical products, and technical engineering services are among the existing capacities for broader cooperation between Iran and Zimbabwe.
Speaking at the meeting, Iran's Minister of Cooperatives, Labor and Social Welfare, Solat Mortazavi, said that the current level of commercial and economic relations between the two sides should increase to at least $500 million per year based on high potentials of the two countries.
The current level of commercial and economic relations between the two countries is not satisfactory, and the two countries should use their capacities to increase their volume of bilateral trade to at least $500 million per year. Zimbabwe has been under sanctions for almost 20 years, and Iran can share its experiences with Zimbabwe in various fields, including neutralizing the existing sanctions of the West.
Addressing the meeting, the visiting Zimbabwe's Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, Makamura Shava, said mutual ties with Iran is taken to be very significant for Zimbabwe, stressing the country will definitely enjoy bilateral friendly ties with the Islamic Republic.
Zimbabwe and Iran are like twins who must learn to cooperate, because both countries have been slammed with sanctions by the West. And in this regard, the West hoped that Iran would go to its knees, Zimbabwe would go to its knees, but thank God this has not happened. So we are here to make sure that we turn the fortunes round and to say that these sanctions which the West imposed on us can be a blessing in disguise.
At the end of the meeting, several memoranda of understanding were signed by the two sides. According to Iranian officials, sanctions have become an opportunity to enhance production and improve human resources productivity, and that Iran is ready to transfer know-how and develop Zimbabwe's energy, transportation, tourism, medicine, and mining sectors. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Syrian foreign minister says the U.S. and some of its European allies are hatching the same plot against his country that they did 20 years ago for Iraq. In a Twitter post, Firas al-Maghdad referred to the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003 on the pretext that it possessed weapons of mass destruction. He said that then U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell staged a scene of manipulation and lies in the UN Security Council to justify the invasion. Maghdad said Powell used America's own satellite images in documents on Iraq's WMD, which later turned out to be non-existent. He added that everything Powell put forward were mere unsubstantiated lies, which he himself acknowledged later. The top Syrian diplomat warned that the U.S. and its allies, namely France and Germany and the U.K., are trying to use a similar pretext to interfere in other countries' affairs. The Ukrainian defense minister will be replaced by the country's head of intelligence following a series of corruption scandals within the ministry. A senior Ukrainian lawmaker said the minister will head the defense ministry, calling for a reshuffle, which is absolutely logical in wartime. He underlined that the circumstances require reinforcement and regrouping. The legislator added that the government will continue such policy in the future, as Russia is preparing to advance further and Ukrainian forces are preparing to defend the nation. The minister was appointed in November 2021. He helped secure Western weapons to boost the country's defense, but his ministry has been beset by corruption scandals. The ministry has been accused of signing food contracts at prices 2 to 3 times higher than the current rates for basic foodstuffs. Meanwhile, the Russian Defense Ministry has accused Ukraine of preparing to blow up buildings in the eastern Ukrainian city of Kamchatka and then accused Moscow of war crimes and targeting civilians in a false flag operation. The Defense Ministry says that the alleged attacks would be used to push Western governments to increase weapon supplies in Ukraine. It says Kiev plans to detonate 3 medical buildings and put the blame on the Russian army. In February, Ukraine's air defense missile in Kiev failed due to lack of proper maintenance and hit the corner of a residential building. Several Ukrainians were killed in the incident, which Kiev initially blamed on Moscow. Several U.S. Republican lawmakers have criticized President Joe Biden for waiting days to shoot down a suspected Chinese spy balloon that had entered into American airspace. Member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Tom Cotton, said the military should never have allowed the balloon to transit the entire continental United States. He accused Biden of aiming to salvage Secretary of State Antony Blinken's planned trip to Beijing. Separately, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee said the balloon traveled unhindered over sensitive nuclear missile sites. Mike Turner said China was using the balloon to gain information on how to defeat the command and control America's nuclear weapons and missile defense systems. Vice Chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Marco Rubio, made similar accusations, saying that China was trying to send a message that it could enter U.S. airspace. An Air Force fighter jet shot down the balloon off the coast of South Carolina on Saturday. Earlier, we talked to political analyst Kinto Shu from Beijing. He tells us the U.S. Shooting down the Chinese balloon could set a dangerous precedent and prompt retaliatory measures.
Well, obviously, this is an incident. The airship is out of control. It's unmanned. And it's because of the strong westerly, or the strong wind, basically, blowing to the from east to the west. And it went astray and deviated from due course severely and straight into the U.S. airspace. The Chinese side has expressed regret and explaining that this is for research purpose, meteorological research in particular. And usually, such an incident, which is not unusual in the history of between countries, let's say, in international relations, but usually it was dealt with by two governments and or by professionals from both sides, because it is not a, it's not a serious issue, but it's a sovereignty issue. I think it should have there's overreaction, and also in a sense it is a bit aggressive, I would say, by shooting down the balloon even after the explanation from the Chinese side, because remember this could be a precedent. Because there's a lot of U.S. military assets flying close or in direct violation of the Chinese sovereign airspace in the South China Sea, in the East China Sea, over Taiwan, for example. If China chooses to retaliate, they can do something like this.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
جانم تپشم سخنم باشد وطنم وطنم ای خان که گوهر خیز بهره وطنم قدمم عشقم سخنم قسمم از عاشقی لبریز.
Congratulations on the victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution.
این
in the limelight.
Many farm workers are still out of work and struggling to afford food in the wake of California's disastrous floods. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Truthout wrote in this regard, one-third of Javier Zamora's organic farm in Santa Cruz County in California is still inundated with water and debris that, under the pressure of ongoing storms, burst from the soil and Carneros Creek. The whole 22 acres just became a lake, he told Truthout. Zamora, the owner of JSM Organics, lost his full strawberry crop, which alone cost $144,000 to put in the ground. Like many growers, he has only just begun assessing the full extent of damage to his farm, which he and his wife pieced together acre by acre over 11 years. He imagines it will amount to no less than $250,000 in damage overall. But Zamora has insurance and trust the disaster relief process. The worst part of the flooding, he said, is that he can't afford to pay the usual 16 to 18 employees who work through the winter. Zamora, whose firm also serves as a classroom for workers he hires and mentors, usually scales down from 48 workers to just over a dozen in the winter months. But this season has been different. He says, I'm broke. There is nothing to sell. The soil is saturated, Zamora said, noting that other extreme weather events like wildfires have also caused dips in employment for farm workers, though for much shorter 2 to 3 day stretches. This is the first time in his experience that operations have been stalled for weeks on end. Though Laura Burst worries that workers who are called on to return to work will be asked to tackle hazardous tasks. These conditions where it's really muddy, slippery, it's cold, your fingers get numb, your feet get stuck, you're operating sharp tools in some cases. This is creating dangers for workers in what was an already risky job. According to the United States Department of Agriculture's National Institute of Food and Agriculture, agricultural work is statistically the most dangerous form of labor. Amid back-to-back deluges, California Governor Gavin Newsom missed a major opportunity to provide relief earlier this month by failing to include funding for unemployment benefits for excluded immigrant workers in this year's state budget proposal, unveiled on January 10th, in spite of ongoing urging by activists. It was an intervention that, while far from a comprehensive solution, could have had an immense impact, advocates say. The decision followed his December veto of proposed legislation to support farm working families in the midst of increasingly variable climatic conditions, which would have made available $1,000 per month in supplemental assistance to households with at least one farm worker. In response, on January 20, a network of 120 advocacy groups known as the Safety Net 4 All Coalition launched a campaign to extend unemployment benefits to undocumented workers on the heels of similar legislation passing in Colorado. A complementary effort is also underway in New York. Oriola Maceda Mendez is a member of the coalition and director of programs for Bi-National Center for the Development of Oaxacan Indigenous Communities, which serves an estimated 160,000 primarily indigenous migrants from Mexico, many of whom now work agricultural jobs and live in California's Valle San Joaquin. Mendez says not having access to unemployment like other workers with documents is not only unfair but also groundless. They pay us the same, they take the same deductions from our checks, and we all pay taxes, she told Truth Out, adding, "Where is this money? Where are these resources?" Plus, according to the Safety Net for All Coalition, California employers pay $489 million in unemployment insurance taxes on behalf of undocumented workers, which in theory should mean there are funds to be had. "We are in a moment in which we need to demonstrate solidarity," Mendez says. "We need to appreciate farm workers for the work that they do day to day, not just with words, but appreciating them and recognizing them by way of providing benefits. At the intersection of social and environmental crises, it's worth noting what is within our immediate sphere of influence, which activists urge include measures like extending the social safety net to all workers, regardless of immigration status, and ensuring that farm workers earn a living wage. Those changes in turn have the potential to lessen the negative impact of the climate crisis, including the sharpening force of winter weather in California on vulnerable, skilled, and essential workers. We cannot control a storm, but we can control the fact that the workers in our food system are paid poverty wages," DeLaura Burst said, adding, "American agriculture is built on the assumption that there is going to be a low-wage labor force that is almost outside of the protection of American law, whether that's undocumented workers or sharecroppers," DeLaura Burst said, adding, "That's really what we are trying to change."
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and here is some interesting points to ponder upon as elucidated to us by the leader of the pious and the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. The whole good is gathered in three characters: consideration, silence, and wording. Every consideration that lacks learning lessons is inattention. Every silence that lacks thinking is inadvertence. And every wording that lacks mention of God is nonsense. Blessed are those whose consideration teaches them lessons, whose silence causes them to think, and whose wording is mention of God, who weep for their sins and save people from their evil.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, self-conditioning in self-building. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of self-conditioning, one of the ways of self-building in the Islamic lifestyle. When we talk about self-conditioning, it means that we need to condition ourselves in order to stop ourselves from following the wrong path or from following some unnecessary or unwanted actions. On the other hand, we condition ourselves to perform the good actions or the things that are needed in our life. Therefore, it is necessary that when we want to have or we want to perform the self-building, one of the ways is to condition ourselves. For example, we condition ourselves in the beginning of the day that I will not perform anything that is against the Islamic teachings. I will avoid the sins, I will avoid the wrong deeds. The way we do in the month of Ramadan, for example, in the month of Ramadan, when we fast, we know that there are a couple of things that are conditioned that during the fasting you should not perform those things. For example, when we are fasting, we are obliged to not to drink anything, not to eat anything, not to perform a sin. We are obliged to fast or be hungry from the time when it starts till the time when we open the fast. So these are the simple examples that we can use, and these are the ways in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted us to be trained. So month of Ramadan and other months in which we have specific things, these are kind of workshops that trains us to how to self-condition ourselves in order to have the self-building, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of self-conditioning in the self-building. We said that it is necessary that we condition ourselves to perform something, and we gave the example of the month of Ramadan. Similarly, on the Hajj, when we go there, that is also a workshop where we are conditioned to not to perform the things that we put on the ihram or the clothes of the Hajj. Therefore, in our daily life, we can learn from these examples, from these months, from these rituals that we practice in the month of in the different months of Islam, or maybe at the time when we are praying in the five-time daily prayers, what we do is when we say Allahu Akbar, which is Takbiratul Ihram, after that, till the salam that we give at the end, we do not look here and there. We just pray. We focus on the prayers and we try not to eat, drink, talk to others or perform anything. Therefore, these are small examples that can help us in order to condition ourselves for the rest of the day that I will not perform anything. And therefore, if I want to have the self-reformation or self-building, therefore, if I'm conditioning myself, for example, from the Fajr prayer till Zuhr prayer, I will try not to perform any sin. And after that, I can condition myself between the Zuhr and Asr, and then from Asr till Isha or the Maghrib. So this way, I can condition myself in order to not to perform any sins, in order to not to do anything which is unwanted, unnecessary, or maybe it is something which is bad in the society. For example, teasing people, or for example, you know, performing some kind of injustice. Therefore, if I can do this, then I can go ahead towards the self-reformation in a better way, an easy way, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Gas prison.
Part 1.
Tehran. The country is on the edge of a precipice. Street clashes are raging between the army and the people. Endless strikes are crippling the country. Prime ministers are being ousted one after another, and foreign nationals leaving the country. The Shah is helpless. The Shah is hopeless. Nothing can assuage the anger of the nation. A revolution is in sight. October 24th, 1978. Tehran, the gas prison. A few months before the Islamic Revolution of Iran, a great number of political prisoners are released after years of being in prison and under torture. Since the beginning of the Pahlavi dynasty, the gas prison had been the graveyard of many political opponents. But within a few months, it would fall into the hands of revolutionaries and a new chapter in the history of this edifice would begin. The name of this prison still conjures up images of many contemporary Iranian figures that fought heart and soul against the Pahlavi regime. The Ghass prison. Over the last two centuries, this building has undergone many fundamental changes, each one mirroring part of this land's history. Tehran, the Ghassr Garden Museum. In 2001, the Ghass prison was closed down after 76 years. In a 10-year project, the municipality of Tehran converted it into the Ghassr Garden Museum. The museum has three main parts: the Markov prison, the political prison, and a large garden the prisons are located in. In the Garden Museum, exhibition stands have been set up, each one representing a critical moment in the history of Iran. A number of political prisoners during the Pahlavi era are here to recount their first-hand experiences for visitors. The building is located in the center of Tehran, but around 200 years ago, during the Qajar dynasty, it was miles away from the city, in a district known as Khurram Abad Hills. In 1798, Fath Ali Shah, the second king of the Qajar dynasty, ordered a recreational palace to be built outside Tehran, a great palace that cost the court dearly.
Tehrani che ma emruz ba in gostare va azamat shahedon hastim.
During the early years of the Qajar dynasty, Tehran, which was the capital city of the country, was about 6 kilometers away from where the Ghassr Garden Museum is now located in. In that era, this place was a green region with nice weather, to an extent that at the time it was known as Khurramabad, or a verdant place.
Iranian palaces share a similar structure. A large garden with small brooks running through, a stately summer house in the middle, and a luxurious mansion at the end with numerous rooms for the Shah and his wives. It is said the palace cost the Shah 400,000 tomans, a huge sum of money in those days. Many foreigners visited the palace, among them Samuel G.W. Benjamin,
the U.S. ambassador to Tehran, Pierre Amédée Joubert, Napoleon Bonaparte's envoy to the court of Fateh Ali Shah, and Madame Carla Serena. Visiting the palace, Madame Serena was impressed by the paintings she saw there. Writing in her travel log, "The palace has been heavenly decorated, and the paintings done in the most delicate fashion." In 1806, His Majesty spent 3 months of March, April, and May at this palace. But the glory days didn't last long. During the reign of Nasser ad-Din Shah, the palace fell from grace and abandoned, a devastating flood razed it to the ground. After that, its precincts were used as military camps and makeshift war prisons. But the future had something else in store. When Reza Shah came to the throne, the country's penal system needed a complete overhaul. The number of prisoners was growing and the old prisons no longer met international standards. The government had to establish modern prisons and recognize civil rights for its convicts.
During the Qajar dynasty, prison was not basically like the one in the Pahlavi era. It was a small building made up of 3 rooms and some rooms in the basement. This was the police's detention center during the Qajar dynasty. But with the growing confrontation between the Iranian nation and the Pahlavi regime, the number of prisoners increased and the regime was prompted to establish a big prison.
The Qajari prisons were old and small, more like dungeons than modern prisons, and couldn't accommodate the increasing number of prisoners. Brigadier Mohammad Dargahi, the Tehran chief of police, requested a new and larger prison. In 1927, Reza Shah commissioned Nikolai Markov, an Iranian architect of Georgian descent, to build the prison. Working for the municipality of Tehran, he had designed many buildings, including Tehran's post office and telecommunications and Alborz High School. Markov decided to build the prison in the south part of the dilapidated palace. The prison took 2 years to complete. In December 1929, it was opened with 192 rooms, designed to house 800 prisoners. In the opening ceremony, Brigadier Dargahi was showing the new prison to Reza Shah and other high-ranking officials. When the group reached the iron cell, the brigadier opened the door for the Shah and asked him and his entourage to step in. But the Shah refused to enter when he was warned by his court minister of a possible coup d'etat. 2 days later, Brigadier Dargahi was relieved of his command and became the first prisoner of this macabre prison. Under Reza Shah, the Ghast prison was the only prison in Tehran. In those days, prisoners were kept together without any classification. Many scholars, writers and poets spent years of their lives within its walls. Mohammad Farrokhi Yazdi, a well-known poet, was one of them. His revolutionary poems were so critical of the regime that he was imprisoned and his lips sewn together with needle and thread. It is widely believed he was put to death at the prison by venous air injection. In the past, there were 2 underground canals that supplied drinking and irrigation water to the palace. Years later, when the palace was converted into the prison, the 2 canals had gushed out to the surface, and prisoners would quench their thirst from the freezing water. Hence the Persian idiom, to drink cool water, was coined. An idiom with a pleasant literal meaning, but an unpleasant reference.
Shot in 1958, the footage shows prisoners busy with various activities. The edifice has seen many hard days when Iran, under the boots of Russian and English troops during World War II, was occupied and ruined, accused of being a nest for German spies. They destroyed the country's army, toppled Reza Shah from the throne, forcing him to exile, and made his son Mohammad Reza the king of Iran. The occupying forces took all national resources into their hands, letting thousands of Iranians starve to death. The year 1953 is a year indelibly imprinted on the mind of the edifice. That year, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, the Prime Minister at the time, nationalised the oil industry, a success that enraged the United Kingdom and the United States of America. On the 19th of August 1953, in an Anglo-American coup, the Prime Minister was removed from power and many Iranian nationalists arrested. The edifice bore witness to the demise of a nation's hope. Mohammad Reza Shah, who had fled the country, returned a few days after the coup.
اگر اون نهضت به شکست منجر نمی‌شد، عملاً ملت ایران در
It's quite natural that hadn't that movement failed, the Iranian nation would have continued its journey toward its historical perfection in a natural fashion and experienced its local balanced development. But the meddling in the national movement by imperial powers, that is the US and the UK, interrupted the current of balance, intrinsic development in Iranian society.
After the 1953 coup d'etat, the nation's pent-up anger came to the surface every now and then, while the regime searched desperately for ways to curb the situation. In the mid-1950s, a new organization was established with the help of the CIA and the Mossad. SAVAK, or the Organization of Intelligence and National Security, aimed to counteract any security threat to the country. Dr. Javad Mansouri was a political prisoner before the 1979 revolution in different prisons across the country.
بعد از کودتای 28 مرداد 1332
After the 1953 coup d'etat, they decided to have a powerful organization to suppress the Iranian anti-imperialist movement, especially since the movement had continued for a long time and the regime was impotent. So in 1956, the bill was officially put forward and approved in Parliament, and with a design by the CIA, this organization was established. The CIA had even an office in SAVAK, and all plans, information exchanges, training, equipment were from the CIA.
کل برنامه‌ها، مبادله اطلاعات، آموزش، تجهیزات با CIA بود.
Nipping any protest in the bud, SAVAK planned to round up all political dissidents in the country. A need for more prisons was urgent now. New prisons were built around the Markov prison. One of them was for political prisoners, where a large number of political opponents of different trends spent years of their lives.
دقیقاً بعد از کودتای 28 مرداد 1332 است که
Right after the 1953 coup d'etat, again due to the increase in the number of political prisoners, and their inherent difference from criminals. In the early 1950s, a separate building was officially built as the political prison.
Of those prisoners, some work as docents at the Garden Museum, telling visitors their stories of the hardship they experienced there. Mr. Hossein Khan Ali is one of them. As a political dissident during the 1960s, he spent 5 years in the Shah's prisons.
There was a man in this prison for 30 years, Safar Khan Qahramanian. This man was for a long time in this room. For 16 years since he was arrested, no one was allowed to visit him. After 16 years, he was called up to the meeting room. He couldn't believe it. He was called a few times and he finally went to the meeting room. When he went there, he saw a woman with a little child and a man with her. The woman called him over. As he stood in front of her in the meeting room, she said, "Father, I'm your daughter. This is my child and this is my husband." Of all his family, only that girl had been left for him. All others had passed away. And that girl came here every week for the last remaining 14 years to visit her father.
After the events of June 1963, led by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, SAVAK, an intelligence agency, turned into a secret police to crush any signs of revolt. And the Iron Fist became the signature of this fearsome organization. Habeas corpus was no longer a right for all people, and forced confessions and long detentions became SAVAK's repeat prescription for any political dissident.
در سال 42 بعد از قضایای 15 خرداد
In 1963, after the demonstrations of June the 5th and 6th, it was decided that suppressing the opponents had to be more vigorous and more extensive, and the opponents had to be treated more violently.
سازمان موساد به کمک ساواک آمد و موساد هم یه دفتری رو
It was here that the Mossad came to help SAVAK. And the Mossad also established an office in SAVAK and began to train, equip, and exchange information with SAVAK.
The 1953 coup ushered in the emergence of leftist parties. Though they couldn't play an important role in the political arena of a religious country like Iran, while the religious movement led by Ayatollah Khomeini aimed to raise public awareness, the leftist groups took arms to fight against the regime. Mr. Dawood As'adi Khamenei was a founding member of the Islamic Society of Students in Stockholm. In 1977, soon after his return to Iran, As'adi was arrested for political activities inside the country. After a six-month interrogation, he was transferred to the Qasr prison. For him, there were two main ideologies in the prison.
در اون زمان دو نظر، دو دیدگاه و دو راه برای مبارزه وجود داشت.
In those days, there were two points of view for the struggle. Some held that the struggle must be a cultural struggle. From a cultural perspective, the society must reach a level so as not to accept a person as
Shah.
But there were some people that believed in the armed struggle. They aimed to announce their stance by killing the people near the Shah. And among those two groups, there were some people that believed in a combination of a cultural and an armed struggle.
با قبول داشتن کار فرهنگی میگفتند در کنارش باید کار مسلحانه هم بکنیم.
Anyway, this issue that the movement must be purely cultural was one of the views at the time which was preferred by many figures, that is, those who were intellectual.
یعنی کسانی که اهل مطالعه بودن، اهل علم بودن، اهل دانش بودن، بیشتر این جنبه رو قبول داشتن.
In 1972, as the armed struggle against the Pahlavi regime gathered momentum, the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee was founded, aiming to establish close liaison between different security agencies and armed forces to confront the opponents. At the same time, a new prison was given to the committee. Many prisoners were killed in this prison under the brutal torture of Savak agents. Dr. Mansouri was in prison both before and after 1971. During his second imprisonment in the Joint Counter-Sabotage Committee prison, he suffered harsh interrogation and harrowing tortures.
از سال 50 رژیم شاه برخوردش با زندانیان سیاسی بسیار خشن، خصمانه.
From the year 1971, the Pahlavi regime treated political prisoners very brutally and revengefully. Before that, they would treat a political prisoner like a bankrupt in a very ordinary way. But from 1971 on, they were facing people they considered as their sworn enemies who intended to overthrow the regime. The treatment was so brutal that they thought no one would dare go this way or that prisoners would never resume their activities after being released.
مسیرا بیاد اگر یه زندانی هم آزاد شد دیگه از حواس زندان نکنه مثلا.
After the year 1971, the regime had initiated a shake-up in the way they treated political dissidents. Almost all of those arrested for political reasons underwent long, excruciating interrogations.
یک روز عصری حالا گویا بازجوها بیکار بودن.
One afternoon, it seemed that the interrogators had nothing to do and were bored. They called me and another young man who had come from abroad and I didn't know him. They put us in front of each other, forcing us to beat each other, but we didn't. They told him to beat me. He refused and therefore they gave him a beating. Then they left him alone and told me to beat him. I also refused, and then they gave me a beating. They beat me very hard. Then another interrogator arrived and said, I know this guy. He is not an important person. Take him to the cell and release him tomorrow. They grabbed my arms and dragged me back into the cell. 1 week passed by, but no one came to release me. After 1 week, they called me and took me directly to the torture room. Usually they would take us to the interrogation room and then to the torture room. They took me directly to the torture room. They aimed to break one's concentration so that one couldn't speak about anything in a measured way.
After endless sessions of interrogation and trials that could take several months, they would be sent to one of the political prisons, including the Qasr prison.
تمام طول مدتی که زندانی در کمیته بود اصلا خانواده از این اطلاع نداشتن.
During the time the prisoner was in the committee, his family would never know of him at all. One could be there for a year or more or less. Whenever their families would go, for example, to Evin Penitentiary, they couldn't find their children. That's why some families knew their children were there.
در صورتی بعضی از خانواده ها می دونستن زندانیشون اونجا هست.
It was clear that the Shah had given the green light to Savak brutality. In hindsight, Savak harassment merely fanned the flames of the revolution. Mr. Davud Yazdani, a former political prisoner, was a soldier during the revolution. He was arrested for his political activities inside the garrison and spent a long time incarcerated in the Qasr prison. Now he's working as a guide at the Garden Museum.
Savak ye zulmi baraye mardom Iran tu mamlakat ijad kard va sakhiriyay kard
Savak's harassment and torture
accelerated the downfall of the Shah, and the Iranian people became stronger and stronger and continued the struggle to overthrow the decadent